This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, September 1st. Filling in for Aldo Bagato, I'm Dante Toza in Philadelphia. In today's newscast, it's the anniversary of the federal minimum wage in the United States. It has remained at $5.15 an hour for the past 9 years. And we'll go to England, where hundreds take action in an attempt to shut down the EU's largest coal-fueled power plant. Those stories and more after these news headlines.
I'm Aaron Glantz with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. George Bush's ambassador to the United Nations called for sanctions against Iran today. John Bolton's comments came a day after the Islamic Republic failed to meet a Security Council deadline to modify or scrap its nuclear program.
We don't have a quarrel with the people of Iran. We have a quarrel with the government of Iran that's pursuing nuclear weapons. The point is, the sanctions would be targeted and not general, and therefore hopefully would have a minimal impact on the regular lives of the citizens of Iran.
The U.S. is virtually alone in its call, however. Haider Rizvi reports from the United Nations.
Today, in Moscow, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov described the controversy over Iran's nuclear program as critical and said it must be dealt with through dialogue, not sanctions. Like Russia, China has repeatedly expressed its reservations about sanctions against Iran. Currently, there is no Security Council meeting scheduled to discuss Iran's nuclear program, and it seems that nothing is likely to happen before the conclusion of the meeting between the European Union political affairs chief and a senior official of the Iranian nuclear establishment. Their meeting is expected to take place sometime next week. Besides that, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan is due to arrive in Tehran tomorrow, where he will meet President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and other Iranian leaders. Meanwhile, former Iranian President Mohammad Khatami arrived in New York today. Iran and the United States have had no diplomatic relations since 1979. Observers hope Khatami's visit could open the door to resolve the conflict peacefully. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Rizvi at the United Nations.
It will take years to clear unexploded cluster bombs used by Israel during its month-long invasion of Lebanon. That, according to Simon Conway of the British group Landmine Action, who spoke to reporters in Geneva today.
We'll be clearing unexploded cluster munitions from the rubble of the villages of southern Lebanon for another decade. That's the grim reality.
The United Nations estimates that 100,000 cluster bomblets that failed to explode lie in Lebanon, with most landing during the final 72 hours of the war. Such weapons, the UN says, continue to kill and maim civilians, especially children, for years after the end of hostilities. Mexican President Vicente Fox will give his sixth and final presidential report to Congress tonight, amidst uncertainty over who will succeed him. The country's Federal Election Tribunal has until September 6th to either declare a winner or annul July's razor-thin presidential election. An extensive police operation is already underway to keep supporters of left-wing candidate Andrés Manuel López Obrador from disturbing today's presidential report. Federal police began installing metal barricades this morning around the periphery of Mexico's Congress. Mexico City's Secretary of Public Security says that 16 different protests are scheduled in various parts of the capital today. Meanwhile, in the southern state of Oaxaca, the movement demanding the resignation of the governor is mobilizing once again. Shannon Young reports from Oaxaca City.
It's impossible to walk even a few blocks in the downtown area of Oaxaca City without seeing signs of a blockade. The colonial buildings of the once famous tourist destination of Oaxaca City are covered in graffiti and protest posters for today's mega march. Oaxaca is now more than 100 days deep into a popular uprising to remove Governor Ulises Ruiz, who has been widely accused of corruption and authoritarianism. Every major state and municipal government office in the capital has been taken over by public school teachers and members of the so-called Popular Assembly of the People of Oaxaca, or APO as it's known in Spanish. A delegation of APO members and unionized school teachers began meeting with Mexico's Secretary of the Interior this week. But the negotiations seem to be going nowhere, as Interior Secretary Carlos Abascal has repeatedly emphasized that his office has no power to remove a governor. For FSRN, I'm Shannon Young in Oaxaca City.
The union that represents more than 4,000 hotel workers in San Francisco is promising more protests after 60 people, including a city supervisor, were arrested in front of a downtown hotel. Max Pringle reports.
The protest came after union hotel workers voted to authorize a strike if a labor deal is not reached with a management group representing 13 hotels. Linda Knighton is a cook at the Omni Hotel in San Francisco. She said workers are prepared to take their case to the streets.
We're not going to get anywhere just laying on our backs. We've got to keep the pressure on them and keep the corporations nervous. As long as they're willing to come to the table, bargain, and do it in good faith, we will meet them at the table.
Union officials say there will be more labor actions if there is no progress made in trying to negotiate a new contract. The previous contract between the union and the hotels expired more than 2 years ago. Hotel workers in Chicago, Honolulu, Toronto, and Monterey have also voted to authorize strikes. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Max Pringle in San Francisco.
And I'm Aaron Glantz for Free Speech Radio News.
More new jobs were created in the United States this past month. 128,000 of them, slightly surpassing government's expectations. But it's a somber anniversary for workers at the lowest end of the pay scale. As FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports, it's been 9 years since the federal minimum wage was increased to today's rate, $5.15 per hour.
The federal government is optimistic about the latest labor reports. Robert Stein is Acting Assistant Secretary for Economic Policy at the Treasury Department.
In our view, the U.S. economy is in very good shape.
Unemployment fell to 4.7% from 4.8% in July. The Labor Department says spending rose at a rate faster than it has since June. Hourly earnings also rose. Compared to this time last year, they're higher by 3.9%, the highest rate since 2001. Some economists say these better-than-expected numbers means the economy is holding off a downturn and could postpone another increase in the interest rates. But Jared Bernstein with the Economic Policy Institute says, although the reports are positive, it's not all cheers, especially for workers on the lower end of the pay scale.
The problem is that lots of workers still don't have the bargaining clout that they need in order to claim a fair share of the growing economy. I mean, there's been lots of observations lately, news articles, reports written. Our book, State of Working America, underscores this, that while the economy's been highly productive and generating lots of income growth, it hasn't been flowing to, say, the bottom 80% of the workforce. For that to happen, you need a much tighter job market, and you're not going to get there with 128,000 jobs per month.
Corporate profits are at an all-time high, and comparatively, lowest-wage workers are earning a smaller piece of the pie. A Census Bureau report released earlier this week further supported that. In other words, the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. Estatement Assistant Secretary Stein acknowledges.
The widening of the income distribution has been a challenge for the United States for the past couple of decades, and it remains a challenge for the U.S.
As reports continue to reveal that low-wage workers are struggling in this economy, it's sure to be an issue that voters will take with them to the polls when they elect a new Congress in November. And that economic debate is sure to include the minimum wage, a hot issue for both political parties. 9 years ago was the last time Congress raised the minimum wage to $5.15 per hour, where it remains in most states. Congress failed to pass a $2 per hour increase earlier this month. The Senate killed it because it was paired with a repeal of the estate tax. As it goes unchanged, the minimum wage debate is longstanding. Conservatives believe increasing the rate will cause hardships to small businesses, therefore cutting jobs. Liberals and some moderates argue that the lowest wage workers must have a living wage. Again, Jared Bernstein.
The current minimum wage is at a 50-year low. In terms of its buying power, it hasn't been this low for a half a century. If you look at the minimum wage compared to, say, the average wage, you'll find that it's only about 30% of the average wage. It used to be closer to 50.
The Census Bureau said the poverty level for a family of three makes less than $17,000 per year. A single mom with two children making minimum wage will make less than $11,000 a year, far below the poverty line. President Clinton allowed states to set their own minimum wage in 1996. Nearly two dozen have taken that initiative. California just voted to raise their wage to $8.50 per hour. And in Santa Fe, New Mexico, that city's wage will raise to $10.50 per hour in 2008. In 3 months, the record will be broken for the longest time lapse between raises in the minimum wage. The record was set during the Reagan administration. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
In July, the UK government published an energy review designed to both tackle climate change and secure affordable energy for the future. The plan is to use a mix of nuclear, renewable, and conventional fossil fuel power stations. Concerned that the government will miss its 2020 target to reduce carbon dioxide emissions by a fifth, hundreds of people tried to shut down the EU's largest coal-fueled power plant. Tom Allen has the story.
600 protesters have spent the last week camped in the shadow of the largest coal-fired power station in Europe. They finally swung into action yesterday and began their attempt to close down the Drax power plant in Yorkshire. Small groups attempted to enter the site, whilst hundreds more blockaded the roads. In total, 28 people were arrested. But the camp was about more than just direct action. Campaigners like Mandy Minkle have been giving workshops and talks about climate change all week. She fears that dwindling oil supplies will see us turning to coal more in the future.
People are now turning to non-conventional oil. They're talking about using coal more, and all these things are much more energy intensive and dirty.
Drax is the UK's largest single polluter and the source of 7% of our energy. Its giant size has made it a target for environmental activists, despite the fact that it is, proportionally, the most efficient and least polluting coal power station in the UK, a record that the company feels has been ignored. We at Drax understand the seriousness of climate change, and we're keen to play our part in delivering a low-carbon future, says Melanie Wedgbury, Drax's press officer. On the phone, she described the different technologies the company was exploring to reduce emissions: co-firing with coal and biomass fuels, turbine reblading, feed water heating, and supercritical boilers. If you took all of these steps, you would actually halve the CO2 emissions from Drax, she claims. But that would require major subsidies from the government. Can coal really be this clean?
The short answer to that is not in the immediate future, and not as far as we can see as the Green Party.
Shona Baird is a member of the Scottish Parliament representing the Green Party on energy issues.
All these things do help, there's absolutely no doubt. And the co-firing is quite a significant step forward in that they're using a carbon neutral material such as wood chip. But we still are not getting down to the real crux of having an absolutely clean, renewable source of fuel. I mean, our CO2 emissions are rising despite all our efforts at the moment.
Demand reduction is the absolute key,
Mandy Minkle tells people at the camp.
We absolutely have to reduce how far we travel, where we buy our food from. We're now supposedly tackling climate change, and yet demand just goes up and up and up. And when you look back to the 50s, people were getting quite into their consumables then. But the amount we used in a year in 1950, we now today use in 2 weeks.
This is Tom Allen, reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
Nigeria plans to release about 10,000 people who have spent up to 10 years in prison without trial. Under the Nigerian law, suspected criminals are usually kept under harsh prison conditions, and sometimes for up to 15 years without trial. The government has for several years been under pressure from local human rights groups to reform its prison, whose conditions are in violation of inmates' rights. Sam Olukoya reports from Lagos.
More than 65% of Nigerian prison inmates are awaiting trial. That's over 16,000 people. Many of them have spent a longer time in prison than they would have spent had they been convicted of the offense for which they have been held. Lagos lawyer Kolawole Ogunbi blames the police and the courts for Nigeria's slow dispensation of justice.
The police who arrest, keep in detention, and charge to magistrate court. What magistrate does is to remand the person in prison custody. It will be after the remand in custody before the police will now commence investigation, which ordinarily you are supposed to do the investigation first before charging the person to court. But rather than doing that, they will keep the person in custody before they commence investigation. And that is why you see people sitting in custody for years before without trial.
Prince Will Akpakpan, head of the prisons project of Nigeria's largest human rights group, the Civil Liberties Organization, says suspects are kept in prisons under very harsh conditions. This perhaps explains the high death rates in Nigerian prisons.
Yeah, the conditions in the prisons are very terrible. If you talk about the health condition, the condition of food, a lot of them, the poor sanitary condition, the toilet system, the food and all that, the very. And the, when you have maybe a cell meant for 10 persons, and around 70 persons are in that cell. Some of them are traumatized. Some of them, their organs are damaged, their eyes, their eardrums and all that because of protracted detention. And this detention is based on inhuman and degrading condition.
Mr. Bayo Ojo, Nigeria's Justice Minister and Attorney General, announced this week that the government is set to reform the prisons. He says besides releasing 10,000 prisoners before the end of this year, the government plans laws to ban indefinite detention without trial. Human rights groups say they are waiting to see if the government can match its words with action. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
In 2006, some 19,000 illegal immigrants traveled on dugouts to reach Spain. This resulted to the Spanish enclaves of Melilla and Ceuta being closed. Today, EU has vowed to strengthen EU border control agency Frontex to handle the flow of immigrants arriving in Spain. But with the use of global positioning system and without jobs, Senegalese youngsters are still determined to go. In Senegal, Jogasek has more.
Babacar Nia is a Senegalese fisherman of 30 years of age. He worked as artisanal fisherman in his family's dugout for years before starting to navigate on European boats, which took him very far on international waters. But last July, Babacar tried another adventure, far more perilous this time, called Mbekemi or the Header, that is crossing the 5,000 kilometers of the Atlantic Ocean to reach the Canary Islands in Spain. After 6 days of voyage, Babacar and his friends had engine problems and got back to the Senegalese coast. But Babacar says he can't continue working in Senegal as the fishing resources have been depleted by EU fishing boats.
For example, if we have 5 tons, 250
EU boats have destroyed our fisheries because when they catch 5 tons of fish, they only need 250 kilograms. The rest is dead small fish that they throw back to the sea. They destroy the grottos where the fish live, and those boats have no boundaries. Very often they fish where they aren't allowed to.
Babacar and his friends have dared to try to cross the Atlantic Ocean thanks to the technological means they now have. Modum Boch, an old fisherman, said that the young fishermen can go anywhere in the world if they have the global position system.
Now young people go to Spain because they have the means. They have the boats that can take them there, and they have the GPS that can show the road to Spain with no problem. The GPS is very important as it can tell you that there is this number of kilometers to travel to reach Morocco or Spain. We use the GPS here for fishing purposes as it can show you the place where you went to fish yesterday and at what time you got there.
In the course of 2006, some 19,000 immigrants reached the Canary Islands, though some 3,000 are reported to have died on sea. Last month, the Spanish Minister of Interior visited Senegal to discuss joint operations involving helicopters and boats to turn back small dugouts carrying migrants from Cape Verde, Mauritania, and Senegal. Also, the EU has already vowed to increase the amount of money available for border control in order to strengthen the capacity of the new EU border agency, Frontex. But Senegalese youngsters are still determined to go. Sanur Job, a young tailor, paid about $800 to go to Spain. Their boat didn't finally reach the Canary Islands, and he never got his money back, but he's still ready to give Mbekemi another try.
If I have another opportunity to go, I'll go, because I have many problems to solve. I can see my mother and my father getting in certain trouble, and I must help them. And I have my sisters and my brothers to help. So the government must solve young people's problems. President Wade should solve our problems.
And the government is trying to bring a solution. Last June, Senegalese authorities presented a plan called REVA to turn youngsters ready to emigrate back to agriculture. But REVA sounds like the French word rêve, which means a dream, and many just take it as such. For FSIN in Senegal, I'm Jaga Sek.
In the eastern Indian state of Jharkhand, a predominantly tribal region, the Indian Army is gearing to set up its firing practice range. But some half-million tribal fraternities facing displacement are dead against their firing range and have embarked on an indefinite peaceful agitation to abort the army's plan. PC Duby has more.
Thousands of tribal members in India organized a peaceful shutdown against the Indian Army use of their land for firing practice, giving an explicit message to the government that they won't relinquish their lands. Members of the community are on an indefinite guard at major entry points of the area to spot the arrival of army vehicles. The moment the village spots army vehicles, they start their old tradition of beating the drums, which triggers a chain of drum beatings in all the villages of the area, beckoning the people to rush towards the entry points to stop the army. Shabri Muthu, a Catholic priest heading alert at local tribal research center, says the government is trying to woo the tribals to part with their land and homes, offering them cash of US$1,200 for 1 acre of land and some US$500 for one house. But the tribals are not willing to barter their ancestral lands and houses for money. Their lands are not mere lumps of soil, but the embodiment of their very existence.
You remove them from the land, you remove their life altogether. They will die without land. They do not have any other skills with them so that they can work on alternative employment opportunities they can take up. And displacement, it's a displacing a community for leading them to death.
The Brizyas, Asuras and the Korbas are primitive tribes in India that have seen their land and livelihood vanish. Father Muthu says their displacement could precipitate their extinction.
And if you remove them, you will remove them from the history of human race. That's why we are saying, please don't touch that area.
Cyprian Kulu, a local tribal, adds that for tribals, forests and lands are not mere means of economic sustenance, but rather cradles of religious cultural heritages. Sarna is the ancestral burial ground in each village and the holiest shrine which can never be replaced.
How can we move to other places deserting our ancestors? Deserting them means betraying our sacred culture and ancestral religion.
Binay Chauve, a local media analyst, concedes the tribal bonding with their ancestral land, but favors the firing range, claiming it would not totally displace the tribals. According to Chauve, some villages will have to temporarily shift once or twice a year during firing practices, but they will be duly compensated.
The government should come forward and convince them that they are not going to suffer any loss.
Chauve firmly believes army presence would bolster development activities in the area, which would revolutionize the tribal's life without tampering with their age-old culture and traditions. But Father Muthu states tribals won't swallow any development baits and will remain on their land even if the military unleashes attacks against them.
You accept the fact that this is my ancestral land and this is my life and I'm ready to give my life, not my land.
From Ranchi in India, I'm PC Dubey for Free Speech Radio News.
The Guatemalan police and military began cracking down this week on poppy growers in the mountains of northwestern Guatemala. Since Monday, they claim to have eradicated 4.5 million poppy plants. The plants are processed to make heroin in the labs across the border in Mexico. They also captured several leaders of the organized crime and confiscated weapons. Local authorities and human rights workers applaud the operation thus far, but say the bigger fish are still getting away. Joe Biblogo reports from San Marcos, Guatemala.
Most crops don't do very well in steep, cold mountains of the San Marcos province in northwestern Guatemala. but the area is ideal for growing poppies, the prime material of opium and heroin. On Thursday morning, around 1,000 police and army troops began a massive raid on poppy fields in San Marcos. In an area called La Vega de Suchiate, hundreds of uniformed men hiked down steep ravines and across hillsides, looking for plots of the bright red flowers. They yank the plants out by hand and take the bigger ones with them as evidence of the hard day's work. The police have also arrested several local drug leaders and confiscated arms and munitions. Just before the 15-day operation began on Monday, the government declared a state of prevention for 5 municipalities in San Marcos. This limits the rights of local residents to carry arms, travel freely, and gather in large groups without authorization. The government can also stop the media from spreading information that could harm the operation. The governor of San Marcos, Axel Lopez, says he's happy that the police are finally taking some action in the area.
En el caso nuestro acá en San Marcos, aparte de todo el tema de narcotráfico, le encontramos que sí tiene objetivo.
The governor says that the place has become lawless. Thugs go around heavily armed. They put up checkpoints on the highway, cut the water supply off for certain communities, and destroy homes. This recent type of police operation, he says, shows the population that the authorities still have some control in the area. Still, Lopez says, as soon as the police and army leave, people here will probably replant the poppy fields. After ripping out the poppy plants, the Ministry of Agriculture delivers a ration of food to families lined up in the tiny village of Nuevo Horizonte. The vast majority of San Marcos families live in dire poverty, so the lucrative poppy growing business is very attractive to many. But the intermediaries and the powerful Mexican drug cartels are the ones who really benefit, says Fernando Bermudez, who heads the Catholic Church's local human rights program.
Yo creo que hay poderes económicos muy fuertes.
I think there are very strong economic powers in drug trafficking here, and that's not being uncovered, that's not being stopped.
Eso no se detienen ahorita.
Drug trafficking and the corruption and violence that go with it has become one of Guatemala's biggest headaches. Last year, two of the country's top anti-narcotics authorities were arrested in the U.S. on suspicion of drug trafficking. Since then, the anti-narcotics department has had little to show for its work. Only 81 kilos of cocaine have been captured this year, compared to 5,000 last year. Police Chief Edwin Spearson says that's because the department is being restructured to try to limit corruption. He also says Guatemalan anti-drug efforts depend on support from the U.S. and other countries along the drug route.
We get a lot of support from friendly countries. In this case, the United States is helping us evaluate where to capture and eradicate drugs.
Police Chief Spearson admits that in the long run, there's not really much Guatemala can do about drug production and trafficking, as long as demand for the drug in countries like the U.S. remains high. I'm Eric Klein, reading for Jill Repligl in Guatemala for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. Simba Russo and Monica Lopez produce our newscast. Aaron Glantz is a headlines editor. Leanne Caldwell is a Washington editor. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Antonio Ortiz and Eric Klein. For archives of this or any other newscast, please visit our website, www.fsrn.org. In Philadelphia, I'm Dante Toza, sitting in for Aldo Bogado.